Hello there, I'm Sagar Baroshi.
And I'm John Ingold.
Welcome to the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope podcast. Every week we flip to a page of the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope book and we interview a contributor about their chosen topic. It is all about the craft of game writing and narrative design. This week, we have Deborah D'Antonio. Welcome, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
We are lucky to have you. And I wonder if you could start by just walking us through a bit of your background. What brought you into this industry and into the world of game writing?
Yeah. So I've worked in PC and mobile games. I've been in the industry for, I think, a bit more than 7 years now. I had my own game studio at some point in my life. That feels like another life at this point. And I made a detour in tabletop games. If you're familiar with the niche of choose your own adventure books compatible with D&D specifically, maybe you know my work from The Mystery of Witchhaven and Side Quest Volume 1. I also work as a volunteer at the IGDA Foundation. And for those who don't know, it's a nonprofit organization that helps game developers, marginalized game developers from around the world, to either break into the games industry or to advance in their careers. So I volunteer as a coordinator there. And yeah, fun fact, my biggest job in tabletop I actually got with a game I made on Ink. So there's that. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Everyone is immediately pleased. Until otherwise, you would have been kicked straight off the podcast. Okay, so. Very cool.
Yeah, I think it's basically my career in a nutshell so far.
Fantastic. Well, I love it when I hear about people using Ink for things, because no one ever tells us when they're using it, which is right and proper. There's no reason why they should, but it's nice to know that it has a life outside of like our little bubble. So Deborah, you wrote an article for the Kaleidoscope book called On the Purpose of Choices and What Keeps Players Engaged. So for the benefit of people who maybe haven't read the article or read it a while ago, could you just sort of summarize for us what was it you wanted to say? What was it you were saying in that article?
Right. I wanted to bring the discussion of what is the purpose of choices in video games and how do we use them. And I think I laid that discussion very gently on what type of choices you should use for what type of situations during a game. And I talk a little bit about even the choice of staying silent during a dialogue or a cinematic, and when that is something that really can be a powerful thing or when it can feel a little bit dull. And also how some games can really be rewarding only through simply by dialogue choices. And I mentioned games like the Monkey Island franchise. What I also forgot to mention, a game that did fantastically, that is Disco Elysium. And yeah, it's basically about how to use these tools to really keep players engaged, but not on the sense of just giving them something to do during the game, more like a means of expression and immersion. Yeah, I think I might be missing something because I also wrote it a very long time ago, but yeah.
Absolutely. No, I think that's very much the gist of it. One thing that stood out for me that I really liked when I was reading your article was you open with this example of giving the player a choice of what's their favorite donut, right? A sort of standard, Do you want the pink one, the red one, or the green one, or however you phrased it.
Yeah.
And you drew the distinction between a choice like that, which feels like a choice from a menu or like a vending machine, you know, what's your flavor of drink do you want today? And suggested rewriting it so that the choices kind of bury the choice of donut inside some other humanities type subtext, some other kind of phrasing or some other mode of expression that wasn't anything about donuts.
Like the and custard, like the custard in the donut. Is that what we're saying? It's buried inside.
Thank you, Saga. Now, I mean, more welcome. Like the phrasing of the choice itself expressing something else. And I just wondered if you could talk a little bit more about when you're sitting down to write a choice, how do you go about deciding how much of it has to be content and how much is the performance of the line and the kind of the mannerisms, and how do you go about sort of making sure that each choice has kind of got enough meat to it that it feels like you've done a good job, but without kind of getting too complicated? How do you sort of think it through?
Right. So depends on the medium that I'm working with. For tabletop, because I had to write based on really giving each class of D&D a way to shine in the story, each choice had to reflect that. So one choice, you can express yourself in a more magical way, the other more like a barbarian, the other more like something in between or something like a rogue would do. And then in games, it's less about who the player is and more about what they want to express as their behavior. So this is why I tend to go for player psychology. And I think, borrowing my own example from the donuts, you can't please everyone. Each person is going to have a favorite type of donut. I know I have strong opinions about my favorite type of donut. So instead of trying to please everyone, I find it best to really try to understand what kind of things the players would want to do on that scene. So that is when I find it more interesting to go for, like, maybe they want to know about the NPC, or maybe they want to just express their own opinion, and that's fine. So even in that donut example, there's an option that, oh, I picked a pink donut. You, the player, don't have to like pink donuts, but you, the player, can relate to that choice because you want to show how determined you are. You want to have a strong opinion about donuts instead of picking something else that is asking the NPC, well, what's your favorite kind of donut? Let's talk about you, not me. And I don't know if that answered your question, but that's more or less how I go about writing choices. And then I also try to make them as different as possible, so that, you know, you can kind of make different groups of players with different behaviors have a say in the game.
So it's very much about taking the choice point as an opportunity for the player to express something in the subtext of what they're doing.
Yes.
And the actual donut isn't that important. I get it. That makes perfect sense. How do you balance that against kind of the long-term impact of choices? Like, are you a fan of measuring those things that players do and kind of trying to build that in later on? Or do you tend to just leave it as a very free-form expression from moment to moment? How do you feel about the kind of the long-term consequences of these subtextual decisions?
I love the long-term consequences. However, I haven't worked in a project that really keeps track of such long stretches in the story. We tend to really create a branch and then quickly converge that line again in the main plot. So it's... I would love to work on something that has like variables that the game keeps track and then gives you consequences later in the story. But so far I have worked more with really small branches that, is, you know, you kind of get this almost flavor text and then you get back to the story, or then you branch into a whole different scene that also has more emotional impact on the player, and then it converges back to the story again.
There was something you said here that I think I haven't really thought about it this way. And it struck me as a really clever way of doing this, both in tabletop and in the computer game format. And that is, you were describing how sometimes what is important is to just imagine what the player overall might want to do in this situation. What's like the typical thing that they might want to attempt to do? But sometimes, depending on the type of game you're doing, especially a game that might involve a variety of quite distinct, specific play styles, say a character class, that it's better to kind of start from the ground up, so to speak. Like, what are the most likely character classes? What are the range of them? Will each of those have something interesting to do? This seems to be a lot to have to stuff into one conversation, right? Is it the case that those things work in conflict, or that one is prioritized above the other? Maybe the situation matters more. You write those, and then afterwards you sort of label them in your head as they work with this class or the other. How do you approach that type of scenario?
Yeah, it can get pretty complex. I would say first you write the story, even as a linear story. Then you start to think about the branches and what are the climax points that you can really inject player agency. And then in those points is when you evaluate, okay, what type of game do we have? If it's a D&D game for tabletop, then we have to make those classes very present in the story. And then on top of the last layer would be now is player behavior choices, because we already covered the classes. Now we can, if we have space and budget for that, then we get those little bit of more emotional and expression things.
I mean, this seems very practical, right? You're sort of saying, well, what's the game I'm making? What have I been contracted to make, or what's the job here? It almost sounds like you're saying you need to start by knowing all the most interesting endings to have. Like, what would people want? Do they want like a climax that's appropriate to their class, let's say? And then you kind of fill in the gaps afterwards. Is that how you would approach these? I only ask because for so many of the stories you've done, it sounds like you have quite a bit of creative control. Like, say, one of the pieces you did in the side quest stories or in Witch Haven, right? Like, you have a lot of structure about how that begins and ends, right? So is that the approach? You kind of you do that, you figure out those endings that are appropriate, and then you kind of find your path to them, or is it different?
Because I have a very kind of technical structural approach to creativity. So if you tell me, well, let's write a fantasy story in medieval setting and it has dragons, and I'm going to be so much cool stuff that you can do with that. I don't know where to begin with.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So I actually love when you give me a restriction, like, no, let's just work with this very specific thing. So the first thing that I do is really create a funnel all of those ideas into, okay, let's talk about this very specific thing and develop this theme in a very specific way. So I start by giving myself constraints and then structure the whole story. So if that depends on the genre that I'm working with. So I work a lot with mystery adventures. And for the mystery, we had this framework like have a 20 page-ish type of story, and it has to have at least two red herrings along the way, and then you have the climax, and then you have the final battle. So we had that structure, and then on top of that I would put the story and then start writing from there.
That's so... It's interesting. We've talked to quite a few writers over the course of doing this podcast, and they're very much split into people who are very kind of, oh, I feel my way through the story, and it's all kind of atmosphere and vibes. And then I think you might be the first person we've spoken to who has quite a structural kind of top-down approach, which is really exciting, actually. That's really interesting to hear about. So I'm fascinated by that. I'm really interested in that. I'd like to talk about that a little bit more. So when you are approaching one of these, say the mystery story example that you gave, how do you know that the structure you've got is going to work? How can you be confident about it? Where are you getting that structure from, and how are you iterating it from project to project? Like, how much of it is set in stone? Where's the wiggle room? Like, where are the bits that change from time to time? How do you go about sort of picking up that structure, basically? Where does it come from, and how has it developed over the course of your writing? I'm fascinated to hear more about that.
Right. Because I have, I think most of my work has been in mystery, I take this framework from the mystery genre, and those are basically my guidelines. Well, a mystery, you have to solve a mystery, and you have some red herrings, and you kind of, that's really basically it for mystery. The wiggle room is just what type of mystery you want to write about. Is a murder mystery? Is some other type of mystery? Are you going like a linear chronological style? Are you going to give flashbacks in the middle to reveal some things? How are you going to... Yeah, that's one important thing about mystery. How are you going to present the clues for the player or the audience? In what order? Are you going to reveal the mystery a little too soon or delay that kind of revelation? The climax of the story needs to be the revelation of the mystery. You have like this skeleton, and then you can kind of do whatever you want with it. So the guidelines I take from the genre as a whole. So if I'm writing something more like a romance or a drama, then I need to shift this entirely and see what actually, most of all, what the readers or the audience expect when they consume that kind of genre. So romance is more, can be more like will they, won't they? So by the end of the story, either they will or they won't. So you have to deliver what you promised for the audience.
So say you're building a will they, won't they romance, and you're sitting down to structure your story, and you go, okay, scene one, these two characters meet. You know, how do you decide, just like really from the basic storytelling approach, how do you decide when to put in a will they moment and when to put in a won't they moment? Like, what's the rhythm of that? What's the pacing of that? How do you stop it from going too far in one direction? Because obviously, if it's all will they and no won't they, then they will. Yeah. Like, do you do that by feel? Do you have a kind of pattern that you fall back on a lot? And where are you getting the feel from? Is it just from reading, kind of consuming romance content yourself and thinking it through? Or are there other places that you get that kind of idea of what the audience wants?
Yeah, consuming a lot of the genre absolutely helps for you to have the gut feeling, the pacing, and the feel of, oh, okay, we've been nothing has happened in a romantic sense so far, so maybe it's time to drop something romantic here. But for a romance, I see that a lot of the hooks are usually centered about drama. So creating drama and dramatic situations of stuff that you can see in soap operas, like just to hook the audience again to, I don't know, maybe your evil twin appears and they're trying to steal your romantic partner. And some things are very cliche, but you can recycle them and put them in a very unique and different way if you can really blend that well into your story. So it's kind of evaluating archetypes just because you already know that they work, but if you're going to use them, try to bring them in a fresh way into your story. But for your specific example, I would say start from the end. Where do you want them to end in the story? How much intimacy are they going to have at the end? Does it end with a kiss? Does it end with something more? What is exactly the will they, won't they? And then try to put the climax, the small climax of the story, be those scenes that are almost there, but not quite. And then something else happens, and oh no, now we have three more chapters about something else that is going to take a turn. And you know, just keep you hooked until you want to finish the story.
Deborah, the way that you think about this is so, you have such a crystal precision with how you sort of think through these different genres and what they might need, that I can see how instinctual that can become over time. And frankly, I wish I was, I wish I had that even more, because it's the one thing that I used to, I suppose, as a less experienced writer, disdain. I used to disdain genre a lot, because I'm like, oh, well, everyone kind of knows what to do. But of course, in every work of art, you are working with audience expectation to some degree, and you can manipulate it. And I'm curious, not just part of that expectation is for you as the creator to have it in your head. This is what a reader or player of a romance game, a reader of a romance novel, a player of a mystery game wants or expects. And if I don't satisfy that, they're going to be upset, right? Yeah. Have you found in your career that it's feasible or easy or doable to understand the audience reaction afterwards in order for you to correct or fix or improve in your next project? Sometimes it can be so obscured in like a review. It's 5 stars, it's 1 star. Like it's hard to know, like, how do people engage with it? That's one real challenge we have with our medium, unlike, say, theater or something, where you can really see the emotional reaction of the person playing it. And unless you have a streamer working on your game, it can be hard. But what's been your experience there? Have you been able to course correct at all? Find reactions?
Yeah, so for Tabletop, I also worked a bit as a community manager for the company. And I got to direct access to the community feedback on that regard.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. So the feedback was not so much about the story or the narrative, thankfully. But it was more about the mechanics, because we were still trying to figure out how to adapt D&D into a choose-your-own-adventure book. And the feedback was more around the difficulty of combat, because some players found it very hard, other players found it very easy. Obviously, the ones that found it easier were more experienced players. So we really tried to... just experiment with what we could do and what we could in a way that also did not need extra materials to play our games, because technically you just needed a book and a 20-sided dice, nothing else. But then how complex the combat could really be, so that you could, you know, play the turns in your head, and then without the need of a board as well to really see the although we had
see where
maps,
the enemies are,
yeah, that kind of thing. So that is something that we really had a lot of feedback, and we were able to, with each adventure, try to shift it a little bit here and there to really try to appease most of the community. Still, there were some people not quite satisfied with the combat. So that was the highest struggle point of Choose Your Own Adventure books.
So going back to kind of the original article, how important to you as a writer, because I get the sense that you have quite a clear sense of the story you want to tell, you know, mystery, romance, D&D, whatever it is, of how it should go, and you know, how the beats of the plot fit together. How important to you is having choice for the player in the first place? Like, are your choices there to try and distract the player from the fact that the plot is going to happen regardless of what they do? Or is the choice there so that the player can co-create that narrative with you? Like, how do you feel about that kind of letting the player in? Is it something you feel excited about doing, or sort of slightly resent having to do? What's your feeling on that?
I really love choice-based games. Although my opinion has slightly changed, because my favorite game was the Mass Effect trilogy. And for
good
me,
choice, good choice.
Yeah, for me, choices was like, oh my god, if a game doesn't have choices, what is a game? But then came Clair Obscur, and I was like, I guess a game doesn't need choices to be fantastic. So, yeah, I still I would say that it depends on the kind of game that you're creating, if you really need choices or not. You really just want to tell this one story that you have in your head. So really adding choices would actually take away from that. Maybe just let the player focus on the story that you want to tell. And sometimes choices can actually enhance your story. And I don't know how to go more deeper into that, because it really depends on the kind of project that you are creating. So I think it's very a case by case scenario.
So can you think of a project that you've worked on where you've really felt the choices have brought something to the experience and really kind of upgraded the experience for you?
Yeah, I think the dating sim genre really shines with that, because it's all about your interaction with NPCs. So you really want to have things to discuss with them, to get to know more about them. And so it's I think it's a very rich place to really just dive into the kind of choices that you can have.
So I'm not very familiar with dating sims in general as a genre. And one thing that I've always been curious about is how much risk does the player have as they're making choices? Like, obviously they're making choices to express what kind of person they're in and what, you know, which characters they're interested in. Does the general design for that come with this sense that I might say the wrong thing or I might do it the wrong way? Is there that risk of failure that, you know, if you go on a real life date, right, there's a huge risk of failure because you might start talking about fishing and then the person you're with says, I am a vegan, and the whole thing ends, right? there's a very real risk there. And obviously a thousand other examples like that. Is that part of the genre? Is that something that you as a writer for that genre are interested in, or is that something that we tend to steer away from so as to give the player a rollicking good time whatever they do? How do you feel about that?
I think specifically in the dating scene genre, you really just want the player to have a good time. Like, you can give them the option to break a relationship to pursue another one, but that comes from their own desire, not because they are just being a terrible at the dating part. I think on dating sims is more about just expressing yourself and how much are you impressing this NPC. It doesn't mean that you can fail and still conquer them, but yeah, on I'm actually more into romancing games that are not dating sims, like in Baldur's Gate 3, which feel a bit more real to me. Like, you can absolutely upset Shadowheart and Astarion, and that can be part of the experience. And later in the game, you can possibly even conquer their hearts again. So there's a lot of flexibility there. And as a player, at least, that's what I find the most interesting in romance in the game.
And I mean, I appreciate you might not have worked on these projects, but do you think as a writer, you would be more interested in trying to write that kind of more sophisticated, if that's the right word, Baldur's Gate kind of dating sim than in the more kind of player focused smooth ramping? Or do you see value in the writing process of both of those?
Both. I do see the value in both writing styles and the narrative structure. But yeah, I would absolutely be interested in writing something more realistic, perhaps. That's the word. Yeah.
This is an interesting point, yeah, because I feel like it is definitely the case that the current phase of dating sims are about, like, a bit more about wish fulfillment and fantasy and imagination of, like, all the different people that your character could be with, and they'll be fun and funny and there'll be silly situations, and it's all a little bit lighthearted. But there was this phase of dating sims that, especially earlier on, where each potential match was like a sort of puzzle to unlock, and you had to kind of work out exactly what it was that they wanted, that would not offend them, or that would kind of allow you to unlock their hearts, so to speak. And that it's a certain type of play that was popular at the time, and probably still has an audience today, that might come in and out of fashion. But yeah, there was definitely risk, like, in those phases. But I see what you mean about the sense of realism in how an actual partnership might work or how it might flow in and out, and for that to be interesting. And I think one of the challenges about these real conversations, and this is what I'm curious how you manage this, whether it's in that genre or in any other type of conversation you're doing. And that is to intuit what the player's intention is when they're picking a choice, how on the nose you need to be with the text of the choice or the emotion of the choice. So, you referenced Mass Effect, which famously had a sort of emotion wheel, right?
Yeah.
And didn't tell you what was going to be said. And there was going to be some distance between what was there and what wasn't there. I feel like over time, particularly RPG players have become they really have come to prefer knowing exactly what's going to be said and ideally the tone in which it's going to be said so that there's no mistake. So they don't accidentally offend someone or the opposite. They don't accidentally, they're not soft when they want to be aggressive, let's say. How do you typically handle that sense of communicating to the player exactly what is going to be said in a conversation?
Right. Usually I have explicitly written the thing that you're going to say to the NPC. I see that when that's not possible is maybe you have a character limit in the engine and your choices need to be shorter than what the player is actually going to say. So in that case, what I try to do is just give a summary of what you're going to say and try to be very picky with the kind of words that you choose so that you get the tone of what you're going to say. But yeah, I absolutely understand what you're saying about RPG players being so. I really need to know what I'm going to do to not upset anyone. I actually always forget what a specific choice is going to do to NPC in Mass Effect, and I always accidentally kill them with that choice. So yeah,
exactly this type of scenario. Well, and especially because you've done tabletop and you've particularly done high fantasy before, I have like a corollary to this question that I'm curious how you've handled. And that is, we might often want to use a mechanical power in a conversation, a magical power, like you might cast a spell on someone and charm them and therefore you get some outcome, or you might just want to, you have a built-in stat for empathy and you want to apply that in this moment. And in some games, you'll give them that tag, like cast charm, charm person, and that line will only work in that context. But I found that almost any time you offer a player some options that are standard and then some options where like you do something, it is very hard to not pick the exciting option, the one that's different, right? How do you handle this? Do you think that we should be using sort of tags, I guess, like this, almost like revealing to the player like what's happening under the skin? How would you do that in a game that's a bit more mechanical in how conversations happen?
That's a hard one. I would say try to make the choices equally interesting. Of course, that having a skill is going to be more interesting for the player. Like, well, I made a specific build. Of course, I'm going to pick my specific skill to use in this context. But what we also did in tabletop was try to not lock content behind a specific class.
So, oh, okay.
Yeah, so maybe you can cast a fireball to really, burn this wall of vines and then clear the path and continue on the story. But maybe you're playing as a barbarian or a rogue and you have no access to magic. So previously in the story, we would offer you a way to maybe acquire a bomb. And then you could also, if you wanted, get easily rid of that same wall. You could do that with the bomb. You could also just cut everything with your barbarian axe, but we always made sure that no content is locked behind a specific class or a specific skill. I don't know, that needs a lot of testing, because that is very hard, to really make all the choices seem very interesting for everyone.
I mean, of course, there's no single answer for these things. But because it seems like you may have confronted that more often than not, so I suppose you could have Yeah, you could ensure that the options represent things like this sort of, this is the option for like the physical way of through this obstacle. This is the option for the social way through this obstacle, you know, what yeah. have you. And if that's your structure, maybe that allows you then to map that to 5e or to another system even actually by keeping it relatively hands off, you know, and that way your adventure could be sold, you know, more widely. That makes sense. I mean, I think this is the challenge of encounter design in RPGs in particular, whether tabletop or video game, is that like it's really hard to come up with an encounter that is equally interesting to handle no matter what character class you have or what yeah. vampire clan you're in or what have you. Yeah,
absolutely.
So what's your favorite kind of choice to write? Like when you're writing, what's the most exciting and enjoyable part of this, of the writing process for you? What's the thing that you get most enthusiastic about?
Would you believe that I never thought about that? Oh, okay. I think my favorite choices are the ones that are dramatic in a way that would make you go like, oh, okay, I picked this choice. What is my friend going to pick? And what is the YouTuber going to pick? And you just want to see the reaction from different people.
Can you think of an example of one that you've written? Sorry to put you on the spot, but it's always really helpful if there's a specific example, whether it's, I'm assuming it's not choosing your favorite donut. So like,
no, it's the kind of thing like dilemmas. So there's no moral choice. There's just two great choices. And maybe you, as the player, really likes one side best, but you know that the other side also has reasons, so you're like struggling, like, oh, okay, nobody's right, both sides are right, what do I pick, who I want to upset? And I think I wrote some of those type of dilemmas for tabletop, where you had to, like, do you sacrifice this thing and then you can save these people? But if you do that, you're going to unleash a demon and, you know, curse this other town. So, yeah, I think that kind of thing.
So it's choices with a high cost to them or a high kind of consequence, whichever way you go.
High emotional cost for the player. I want to make them right. cry.
Yeah. Okay. You want to break people. Okay.
Yes.
I'm glad you brought this up, actually. I'm glad you brought this up because when I was reading your article, this is one thing that did occur to me, which is we of course want to make choices that ask the player to express themselves. We of course want to make the player feel something, right? Like to feel like they're sort of going into their soul. Is there a risk that if all or the majority or many of the choices are that weighty, that it's that the game becomes heavy to play perhaps or heavy to experience? Like how would you balance the pacing of these types of dilemmas? Like something like what you described, right? Should the game be culminate? Let's say it's an adventure, right? Like a module adventure for tabletop, right? Should that culminate to one big final dilemma? Or should there be dilemmas along the way? Like should there be a choice that you make at the beginning that is advertised to the player, this is a dilemma that will choose this faction or this faction and that will determine who the enemy is at the end, let's say. Mm-hmm. How frequently should we see these big moments?
I would say what will mostly define that is the budget and the scope of your project. So,
right, yeah.
The most simple one would be let the biggest choice be the climax of the story, be the end of it. But if you have the room for it, you can add more dilemma and maybe even make those dilemmas have an outcome at the bigger ending. Let them dictate that instead of just also letting the player choose at the end. That in this way, they will have more impact in the story, like, oh my god, all of my choices funneled out into this whole big scene at the end, and I could see everything unfold. But in terms of pacing in the narrative, I would say to really try to tie those dilemmas, those moments, with the hooks of the story. So try to balance that with high tension and climaxes, and then after that you need to give the player a bit of space to breathe so that they can, you know, process those feelings from all of that action and drama and tension. And right. Now we have some downtime. We are going to talk with NPCs. We are going to have some tea because 15 minutes after this, we are going to jump into another battle and start to raise the curve of tension again. And then we can, at the highest peak of that, put another kind of dilemma. So it's really about balancing these high stakes, low stakes moments to let the player rest, but also let them yearn the next moment that they will have this really high moment of agency in the story.
So again, yeah. I'm understanding that you have a really strong feeling for the structure of the story in quite an abstract way. It's sort of, you could almost graph it. Like, here's a high tension, here's a low tension to buy the next high tension and things like that. That makes a lot of sense. Amazing. I love the kind of clarity, of that. I'm not sure when I'm writing myself whether I actually know half the time whether a situation is a high tension moment or a low tension moment all the time. I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, let me ask one last thing about this structural point. And that is, how often do you use narrative structural tools for this? Of course, there's like the classic kind of Western three-act structure that we might use. There's prop and his sort of folkloric way of thinking about things. There's so many different narrative structures, of course, right? Do you find it helpful to layer something like that on top and say, cool, we're going to have rising tension, we're building to a climax? How do you usually approach that?
Yeah, I think that helps a lot right from the brainstorming phase, because when I don't use something like the three-act structure or even the genre, like I said, for mystery games, I usually write the beginning, some cool scenes in the middle, and then the end, and I'm like, okay, I don't know how to connect this stuff. What do I do right. now? Yeah. So really... using those guidelines and the three-act structure, for example, really help you just visualize that and say, oh, okay, I need to have the climax here and I need to do something more to hook the player here. And then it's more of, after that, it's like, well, okay, you know the rules. Now you can break them however you want.
Yeah, okay, cool. That makes sense. Let me then take that as a chance for us to wrap things up. So thank you very much, Deborah, for coming to join us here on the podcast. Listeners, please join us next week when we will open the book yet again and bring on another contributor to talk about their article for the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope. Thanks very much, and we will see you next time around. Bye-bye.
Bye.